From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now! Countdown to the showdown, the battle for the White House. Four days before the presidential election, Osama bin Laden resurfaces in a tape message addressing the American people. We'll speak with Middle East correspondent Robert Fisk. Then the NAACP is under investigation by the IRS after its chair, Julian Bond, criticized the Bush administration. A new study finds at least 100,000 Iraqi civilians have died because of the U.S. invasion. We'll speak with one of the authors of the report.
What I find most fascinating is that with seven brave Iraqis and less than $40,000, we could go out and make a reasonable estimate of the death toll, and yet with all the millions of dollars spent on intelligence, the coalition authorities haven't been able to do the same thing.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the countdown to the showdown, the battle for New York. I'm Amy Goodman. With one day after the presidential elections, reports are coming in across the country of efforts to confuse, intimidate, and discourage voters from going to the polls. Ian Sancho, the supervisor of elections in Leon County in Florida, told the Washington Post, quote, "In my 16 years as an election administrator, I've never seen anything like this." In Florida, thousands of students have learned not only was their party registration switched to Republican, but their home addresses were changed. This means when they show up at the polls at their local precinct, their names won't appear on the voting rolls. In Pittsburgh, flyers were handed out on what looked like county letterhead that claimed voting had been extended an extra day, quote, due to immense voter turnout expected on Tuesday. The flyers said Republicans should vote on Tuesday, Democrats should vote on Wednesday. In Wisconsin, flyers purportedly from a group calling itself the Milwaukee Black Voters League told voters, quote, "If you've already voted in any election this year, you can't vote in the presidential election. If you violate any of these laws, you can get 10 years in prison and your children will get taken away from you." In South Carolina, a letter purportedly from the NAACP warned voters they cannot vote if they have outstanding parking tickets or have failed to pay child support. Meanwhile, in Ohio, a pair of civil rights activists have filed a lawsuit to block the Republicans from challenging the eligibility of any voters at the polls on Tuesday. The couple, Marion and Donald Spencer, said the Republicans are basing the challenges on a law dating back to Jim Crow era that was originally aimed at disenfranchising black voters. In Georgia's Atkinson County, the Republicans attempted to challenge the voting eligibility of 78% of the county's registered Latino voters. But on Thursday, the Board of Registrars dismissed the Republicans' complaint. The county attorney said, quote, "The challenges are legally insufficient because they are based solely on race." The Guardian of London's reporting, filmmaker Michael Moore, has announced plans to send 1,200 videographers to polling stations in Florida and Ohio. Moore said, quote, "I'm putting those who intend to suppress the vote on notice. Voter intimidation and suppression will not be tolerated." The newly formed Election Assistance Commission officially announced Sunday that the country will likely have 500,000 fewer poll workers than needed for the elections. The commission called on businesses to allow employees to take the day off from work so that they can work at the polls. In news from Iraq, dozens have died in another bloody weekend of fighting. U.S. forces suffered their deadliest day in 6 months on Saturday when 9 Marines were killed. 8 of the Marines died in a suicide bombing near Fallujah. Earlier today, Baghdad's deputy governor, Hatem Kamal Abdel Fattah, was killed in a drive-by shooting. On Sunday in Tikrit, a rocket attack killed at least 15 people. On Saturday, a car bombing exploded outside the Arabic satellite TV station Al Arabiya. 7 people died, 18 were injured. It was the deadliest attack to date on a media outlet in Iraq. An Iraqi resistance group calling itself the 1920 Brigades blasted the Saudi-owned station as a treacherous network that was run by, quote, Americanized spies speaking in Arabic tongue. Also on Saturday, Iraqi security forces killed 14 Iraqis south of Baghdad. The unelected Prime Minister Iyad Alawi warned that a full attack on Fallujah will begin soon. Meanwhile, leaders of the Iraqi resistance threatened to use chemical weapons to defend the city. Rebel commanders said chemicals such as cyanide have been added to mortar rounds and missiles. In other Iraq news, the Pentagon has extended the Iraq tours of duty for 6,500 more soldiers. On Friday, Al Jazeera aired portions of a new address by Osama bin Laden, in which he took credit for the first time for carrying out the September 11th attacks. He also cited the U.S. backing of Israel during the invasion of Lebanon in 1982 as another reason for his actions. Bin Laden said, quote, "While I was looking at these destroyed towers in Lebanon, it sparked in my mind that the tyrant should be punished with the same end and that we should destroy towers in America so that it tastes what we taste and would be deterred from killing our children and women." Bin Laden also said, quote, "Your security is not in the hands of Kerry, Bush, or Al-Qaeda. Your security is in your own hands. Any state that does not mess with our security has naturally guaranteed its own security," he said. On the campaign trail, Senator John Kerry again criticized President Bush for failing to capture bin Laden in Tora Bora. Kerry accused Bush of making the mistake of outsourcing the attack to Afghan warlords instead of using U.S. troops. The Bush camp gave a mixed response to the bin Laden tape. One member of the team described the tapes as a, quote, gift to the campaign. Political analysts said it's uncertain whether Kerry or Bush will benefit from the so-called October surprise. Reuters is reporting the Bush administration will seek to unseat Mohammed al-Baradei from his post as the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency if Bush wins Tuesday's election. Al-Baradei, who is considered a frontrunner to win this year's Nobel Peace Prize, has been at odds with the Bush administration for years. Now the White House is accusing al-Baradei of meddling in the U.S. elections because the IAEA reported last week that 377 tons of explosives had gone missing at an Iraqi military base that the U.S. failed to secure. The missing explosives have become a major issue of debate over the last week. The Associated Press is now reporting as much as 250,000 tons of munitions may be missing in Iraq. Over the weekend, Human Rights Watch announced it had warned the Bush administration about securing the explosives at Al-Qaqa. Meanwhile, the Boston Globe is reporting that UN weapons inspectors attempted to enter Iraq after the invasion to monitor Iraqi weapons sites, but were blocked by the U.S.-led coalition. In Israel, 4 people died in a suspected suicide bombing in Tel Aviv. 30 more people were injured in the blast. The attack occurred in the city's central market. Sunday, the executive committee of the Palestine Liberation Organization met for the first time in over 30 years without its leader, Yasser Arafat. Arafat is in France receiving medical care. Aides to Arafat now say he is in stable condition, that he does not have a life-threatening condition. Doctors said it does not appear that he has leukemia. And Haaretz is reporting a total of 165 Palestinians were killed in the West Bank and Gaza in October, making it the deadliest month for Palestinians since April 2002. In Afghanistan, the Taliban has threatened to kill 3 United Nations workers held hostage. And the 2003 Nobel Peace Prize winner, Shireen Ebadi, is suing the U.S. government in an attempt to overturn a law that's barring the Iranian attorney from publishing her memoirs here. This according to a report in the Wall Street Journal. Under a trade embargo, the U.S. government bars the publication of new works by authors from Iran, Cuba, and Sudan. Ebadi said the restrictions, quote, seem to defy the values the United States promotes throughout the world, which always include free expression and the free exchange of ideas.
Rulers of the nations, as you fuss and fight over who owns this or that and who has the right to design, build, sell, and store and fire all the bombs and guns to defend your holy empire. There are children hungry, children sick and dying. There are mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers crying. They're only pawns in your play of power and corruption. Slowly starve them, your new weapon of mass destruction. And prove to me, America, that you care. And prove to me, America, you're aware. Who's dying for your freedom in this land? For the liberties you demand.
Sarah Thompson, Is It for Freedom? Here on Democracy Now!'s special election coverage countdown to the showdown, the battle for the White House. I'm Amy Goodman. The final Gallup poll of the 2004 election was released Sunday, showing President Bush and John Kerry in the closest presidential race in the history of Gallup polls. The polls give Bush a 49-47 lead over Kerry, a statistical dead heat. At least 10 states could end up going to either Bush or Kerry. Of six states polled by Gallup, Kerry was slightly ahead in three: Ohio, Florida, and Minnesota. Bush had slight leads in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Iowa, although a Des Moines Register poll released Sunday had Kerry up slightly in Iowa. And other polls released over the weekend showed Kerry ahead in Pennsylvania and Bush ahead in Florida. In all six states, terrorism or the war in Iraq were named by at least half of the prospective voters as their primary concern. The poll comes as the newest videotape message from Osama bin Laden dominated the Sunday talk shows. Some are calling it a mini October surprise. The tape was broadcast Friday afternoon by the Arabic network Al Jazeera. Bin Laden appears to be in good health and is dressed in a gold-colored robe, standing at a podium reading from prepared notes. The 18-minute address was directed at the American people. Bin Laden mentioned both Bush and Kerry by name, saying that neither of them can bring security to the people of the United States. On the tape, bin Laden says that the motivation for the September 11th attacks goes back to the 1982 Israeli invasion of Lebanon and the U.S. support for the invasion. He said, quote, as I was looking at those towers that were destroyed in Lebanon, it occurred to me we have to punish the transgressor with the same, and that we had to destroy the towers in America so that they taste what we tasted and they stop killing our women and children. Bin Laden blasts Bush's handling of the 9/11 attack, saying, quote, we never knew that the commander-in-chief of the American armed forces would leave 50,000 of his people in the two towers to face those events by themselves when they were in the most urgent need of their leader. He was more interested in listening to the child's story about the goat rather than worry about what was happening to the towers. So we had three times the time necessary to accomplish the events, bin Laden said. He compares the Bush administration and the Bush family to Gulf monarchies and military dictatorships in the Middle East, saying Bush, quote, moved the tyranny and suppression of freedom to his own country, and they called it the Patriot Act, under the disguise of fighting terrorism. And Bush, the father, found it good to install his children as governors and leaders, bin Laden said. He dismissed the Bush administration's contention that the attacks were carried out because al-Qaeda hates freedom. Bin Laden asks, if we hate freedom, let him tell us then, why did we not attack Sweden? Robert Fisk joins us on the line right now, the chief Middle East correspondent for the London Independent, author of Pity the Nation, The Abduction of Lebanon. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Robert.
Thank you.
Your reaction to the bin Laden tape?
Well, it clearly is time for the election. And indeed, it looks to me like he's voting for Bush. Although he tells the American people, you know, it's in their hands, not Bush or Kerry. He's always had this notion. I remember in 96, I thought it was so outlandish, I didn't even put it in my report of our meeting. He had this idea that the American people would shrug off the American government and would the individual states of the Union would become individual countries, a bit like Yugoslavia has now become. I said to him at the time, I don't think you seem to realize the American people vote for the government in the United States, which they don't in, of course, Saudi Arabia and most other states in the Middle East. And he just seemed to let that go. I mean, he was obsessed at the time with Somalia and how the Americans were paper tigers there. I must say, when I read that he was telling the American people that Bush couldn't protect them, I mean, he didn't do very well in protecting Afghanistan for the Americans, did he? But this is clearly Osama bin Laden coming back into the picture. You have to realize that he is, and this is a fact I can promise you, he keeps up with television news reports, writing, and so on. So he knows what is being said. The idea of thinking that, you know, he's out of touch and so on, he might have been many years ago, but not now. He's not an internationally shrewd figure. He's never traveled very much, although oddly enough, he has been to Sweden. I did notice that reference to Sweden in the text. He's actually been there. But he does understand what's going on in the rest of the world, and so therefore this was a clear attempt to come in. My belief is that he would calculate correctly that a tape in which there's a further threat against the United States by the people who, well, he actually says it himself, virtually, you know, he admits it, doesn't he? The idea occurred to me of the Twin Towers and the International Crimes Against Humanity of September 11, 2001. I'm sure he realizes that further threats are more likely to help Bush than Kerry. And what Osama bin Laden wants now, of course, is a president to be elected who will further mire the country into the Middle East swamp and cause, of course, more American casualties, which Bush will surely do. So I think this was probably Osama bin Laden's vote for George W. Bush.
We're talking to Robert Fisk, who interviewed Osama bin Laden twice.
Three times.
When did you interview him, and how does he compare in how he looks to when you interviewed him?
Well, it's an odd thing to say, and I noticed this before the American bombardment of Afghanistan. When I used to see him, he was always dressed very humbly in a white galabia, you know, a cheap cotton gown and a kufiya headdress like any Palestinian or Gulf Arab might wear. But more and more now, he appears, when he does appear in videos, with sort of gold fringed robes. And I wonder if there's not a certain amount of vanity crept into his personality. After all, he is a fairly well-known guy now. And I wondered if there wasn't, I could see sort of something of the Mahdi there, you know, the person who began to believe that he was the personal sort of interpreter for some higher being. It's interesting that he constantly wants to be portrayed, or did before, as being in a cave. And of course, the Prophet Muhammad for a period lived in a cave. And indeed, he was on a mountain outcrop when he first received the message from God. And I wonder what actually is going on, not politically over the United States or attacks, but I wonder what's going on in the bin Laden mind. And that's not the first time he's had such a smart gown on. He was wearing it like that in 2000. But before that, he was a much more humble figure. But I suppose you could say before that, he probably thought he had more to be humble about.
And yet, interestingly, he did not make any reference to the Quran.
Well, I think the tape was slightly longer than the one you've seen, and I believe he does make a reference to the Quran in the full half-hour tape. You talked of it as 18 minutes, but it hasn't all been aired. I've spoken to the people who got the original tape, and there are a number of Quranic expressions. So that's not quite right, but it's not your fault you got it wrong.
I wanted to read to you Walter Cronkite's comments. I don't know if you heard about them.
I know who Walter Cronkite is, but I haven't heard his comments.
Well, he said this on Larry King. He said, so now the question is basically right now, how will this affect the election? And I have a feeling that it could tilt the election a bit. In fact, I'm a little inclined to think that Karl Rove, the political manager at the White House, who is a very clever man, he probably set up bin Laden to this thing. The advantage to the Republican side is to get rid of, as a principal subject of the campaigns right now, get rid of the whole problem of the Al-Qaqa explosive dump.
I don't really think it's worth much comment. I mean, I know the timing and the dates when this tape originally arrived in Islamabad, and I don't think anything could have been. It wasn't, for example, it didn't arrive 5 weeks ago and was then held up till the right moment in the election, if that's what Cronkite was suggesting. I don't think there's any. I think that's a conspiratorial theory. There's a lot of things in this which suggest that bin Laden is, oddly enough, actually trying to talk to Americans. You see, at the very beginning, when he says, Bush is still misleading you and misinforming you by not telling you the truth. The odd thing about that is that an awful lot of people would say that bin Laden is quite correct and accurate in saying that. He's not correct in much else of it, but in that he certainly is. He never was, of course, in Beirut in 1982. You know, he keeps going back to the Lebanese invasion, although he certainly would have seen pictures. And I saw the real thing in Beirut, of whole apartment blocks crumbling to the ground with all their occupants inside, after the Israelis had bombed the buildings from the air, claiming that, quote, terrorists, unquote, were inside, when in fact, in almost all the cases I went to, they were just civilians, families, babies, children, who, of course, were flattened like pancakes underneath this mass of concrete and iron. They looked, frankly, when I saw them, very much like the dead looked of September 11. So I'm not making a direct comparison. That's what bin Laden's doing. But I understand what he's talking about when he talks about the destroyed towers in Lebanon. The odd thing is, there's a slightly wrong translation from the Arabic. He says that, you know, he never thought of an attack on the Twin Towers in New York. What he actually said in the Arabic was, I had never thought of doing it until I saw what had happened in Lebanon. Then the idea occurred to me. In other words, he's saying that the inspiration came from Israel's invasion rather than him sitting down and saying, oh, there's a good target. I'm not sure I believe him, because it's quite clear that the targets which were chosen were to represent finance and the military. And if indeed Ziad Jarrah's plane, the Lebanese hijacker, got through, I assume that would have gone for the legislature, that would have gone for Capitol Hill. Interestingly enough, Ziad Jarrah himself was in Beirut during the Beirut siege, and his family, whom I've met, managed to get him out. He was a small boy at the time, fascinated by aeroplanes and flying, oddly enough. He was just a schoolboy, actually attending a Christian school. And his father told me that after he'd got out of Beirut and he'd seen these air attacks, he refused to play with his sister in the park or go to the swings because he said what had happened in Beirut was too serious. And, of course, it naturally occurred to me when I heard bin Laden speaking that if he'd met Ziad Jarrah, and I rather suspect he had, Jarrah himself may have given his childhood memories of what happened in Lebanon to bin Laden. But that might sound as conspiratorial as Walter Cronkite. I don't know.
Robert Fisk, Middle East correspondent for The Independent. We have to break for 60 seconds. When we come back, I want to ask you very quickly about Yasser Arafat, his health, and the significance of his going to France and his leadership in Palestine and Israel's struggle. And want to ask you about the deadliest weekend we have seen in Iraq over the last 6 months for U.S. soldiers. And then the study, 100,000 Iraqis dead. Stay with us.
Thank you.
us, Samir Gibran, here on Democracy Now!, the countdown to the showdown, the battle for the White House. I'm Amy Goodman. Robert Fisk on the line with us, Middle East correspondent for The Independent. You wrote a piece on Saturday, Robert. The title, "The Truth Is That Yasser Arafat Died Years Ago. He Married the Revolution, and in the End, He Became a Little Dictator Falsely Promising Democracy." Your response to the latest news of Yasser Arafat and his health?
Well, he's died so many times, hasn't he? I mean, we were told originally he died in one of those air raids in Beirut in 1982, and he didn't. Then he had a crash in the Libyan desert in his plane, and he was okay, but the pilot was killed. And then he had a blood clot in the brain on the way to Baghdad from Amman, and Jordanian doctors saved him. This time, of course, it clearly is serious. Although, I mean, in a way, when you look at it symbolically, this old man, like an elderly owl who's been trapped inside this rubble for 3 years, still talking about going to Jerusalem and leading his people to a new state and so on, peace of the brave, and then eventually he's hauled out on a stretcher looking like a skeleton and taken off to a foreign country from which he may never return alive. It's not the way in which leaders should go. But the problem is, you see, that all along he never allowed a new leadership to take shape around him. He was a corrupt man. He is a corrupt man. He won't be doing much corruption for a while now. But all this time, and this is the great tragedy of the Palestinians, apart from the fact they're living under occupation, which is a greater tragedy for them, is that this was a man who didn't allow young and educated Palestinians to take their place in a new political entity. If you look at the pictures, or look at any of the pictures you see of Arafat outside the Muqadda building in Ramallah, or you look at the pictures of him coming out and when he was led out of the building and put on the helicopter, all the men around him are paunchy 50, 60-year-olds, has-beens from the days of fighting the Israelis in Lebanon in the 80s. Whenever a bright young spokesman has popped up on television from the Palestinian side, they've been slapped out, and the old men have been brought back, like, for example, the Palestinian representative at the United Nations, who's almost incomprehensible on television or radio, especially when the Israelis put up extremely eloquent and well-educated young people to represent their country. So he's, you know, as I've said many times, even Arafat as a physical existence. I mean, that's not a face that you'd see on a student dorm window, along with Che Guevara or even Castro. In a sense, you see, he represents, by his continuity, by his desire to represent the revolution, to be married to the revolution, as he put it, which his wife later found out what that meant, it has a consistency and a kind of courage to it. But he had everything wrong with the Arabs, in the sense that he turned into just another Arab dictator, which is exactly, I think, what the Israelis wanted. They wanted an obedient dictator to manage the occupation for them. It was interesting that when the Second Intifada broke out, the Israelis asked the question, can Arafat control his own people? Which, of course, was dutifully taken up. The Israelis set the agenda for CNN and the BBC, who said, can Arafat control his own people? Having forgotten that the principle behind the Oslo agreement was not that Arafat would control his people, but that he would represent them. And in a sense, he does represent them, because in the streets, there are people who say, we need control, you see. And one of the great sicknesses, I think, the cancers of the Arab world, is the desire for people to put a form of authoritarian regime over the freedoms of the kind of democracy that we think we live in. I'd have to say, however, that if I was an Iraqi living in the hell of Iraq at the moment, I might well look back wistfully on the terrible days of Saddam compared to the infinitely more violent and dangerous days today.
Speaking of which, latest question, what's happening in Iraq right now, as well as the capture, the kidnapping of Margaret Hassan and the threatened, what will happen to her, the killing of the U.S. soldiers and the 100,000 report, which we're going to talk about in a minute, of casualties in Iraq, Iraqi civilians?
Well, you know, the problem is that although some of us, when we go to Iraq, are still moving around, most of my colleagues, and I don't blame them at all, scarcely leave their hotels because it's too dangerous. I mean, we've still got the two French journalists missing, although mercifully I understand they're still alive. And, you know, we've had journalists murdered, quite a few of them. And so when you talk like this, for example, I've just listened to your questions, excuse me, we're constantly faced by this kind of theatrical facade. I mean, who has Margaret Hassan? We don't know. I know Margaret very well, but there's no claim from a particular group. There are no armed men standing in the background with Islamic banners. Who took her and why? We hear, eight Marines were killed. On operational duties. What does that mean? What were they? Were they ambushed? Were they in a tank that blew up? Were they in a helicopter that crashed? What does it mean? We hear 100,000 casualties. Well, there are two ways of getting a casualty rate, a rough casualty rate in Iraq. One is to go it around all the scholarly notebooks of doctors and the morticians who wrote down five more bodies at 2:17 p.m. this afternoon, to go to all the hospitals, to go to the Ministry of Health. And when we've done that, and of course the Associated Press had a pretty good go at this before most of Iraq went outside government control, we came up with a figure that got to around 20,000 to 30,000 Iraqis. The figure of 100,000 has been extrapolated from a series of interviews in specific locations based upon percentages. In other words, if they went to, you know, five houses in a street and found that 20 more people had died of violence than the previous year, then they would extrapolate out from that the increase in violence and what it meant. But the 100,000 is not a record of actual death. It's an extrapolation of percentages put forward in what is, in effect, a kind of opinion poll. So it may be less than 100,000. It may be considerably less. But I think that when you get to the point where you're sort of saying, my God, it wasn't 30,000, it was 100,000, you're beginning to forget the individual. And it's the individual Iraqi who is suffering every day, every day, every day. And there are many, many deaths that will never be recorded simply because in a small village out in the desert, they will bury the person quickly. And the authorities effectively have no control there anymore. There's no one to take down deaths. There's no one to notify. In Baghdad, you still have to notify deaths. So you can go down to the city mortuary at Baghdad City Hospital. And I actually do go there and I meet the doctors and the morticians. I actually stand there among the corpses and we can count them each day. Now, that I can do, and I can tell you, you know, on a certain day, 27 people were brought with gunshot wounds into this hospital. And I can do all the hospitals in Baghdad, but I can't travel to Najaf and Samarra and Fallujah and count there, too. So there will be no precise statistic. And that, of course, is precisely the way that the United States and Britain and the American military and America's appointed Iyad Alawi, so-called interim prime minister, that's the way they want it.
Well, Robert Fesco, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Middle East correspondent for The Independent interviewed Osama bin Laden three times. We're going to turn now to that study and to one of the authors of the study here in the United States, which said at least 100,000 Iraqi civilians have died since the invasion last year. It is an independent peer-reviewed study entitled Mortality Before and After the 2003 Invasion of Iraq, a cluster sample survey, appears in Britain's foremost medical journal, The Lancet, conducted by researchers at Columbia University, Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, and Al-Mustansiriya in Baghdad. The estimated number of deaths of 100,000 is considerably higher than previous estimates. The study found the rise in the death rate was mainly due to violence, much of it caused by the U.S. airstrikes on towns and cities, many of the victims, women and children. The U.S. military claims it does not keep tallies on civilian casualties, but the London Independent is reporting the Pentagon does collect data on Iraqi casualties and is keeping the results classified. According to The Independent, the U.S.-backed interim Iraqi government has also suppressed casualty figures. An official at the Iraqi Health Ministry who is compiling data from hospital records last year was ordered by a superior in December to stop. Les Roberts joins us, co-author of the study. He's an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be with you.
It's good to have you on with us. Explain the study, and you were just listening to Robert Fisk, your response.
Sure. What we did was we got a breakdown of where people lived before the invasion. How many people were in Anbar province, how many people were in the city of Mosul, and so on. And we at random picked 33 neighborhoods throughout the entire country, essentially in a way that represented the population distribution on the 1st of January, 2003. And then when we'd go to those little villages or city neighborhoods, we would pick a point at random. We'd draw a map and just pick one point on it and go to that point and visit the nearest 30 houses. And we'd knock on the door, and we'd say, hello, we're from El Mustansaria University. We'd like to ask you a couple of questions. And we said, who lives here now? And they gave us the age and the gender of everyone. And then we said, on the 1st of January 2002, who lived here? And then we asked, had anyone died or had anyone been born in the time in between? And my one sort of contradiction of what Mr. Fisk said is this wasn't an opinion poll. On a subsample of the deaths, at the end of the interview, when the people didn't know we were going to do this, we said, could you please show us the birth certificate? And 4 out of 5 times, the people could go back in their house and come back with the birth certificate. So we're quite sure people didn't make up these deaths. I mean, these are something quite tangible, and lots of the people wept as they described the deaths. So by going back to the beginning of 2002, we essentially knew the rate that people were dying at before the invasion, and we now know the rate after the invasion, and we compared the rates of death and realize this is a nice advantage that every neighborhood is sort of being compared to itself. In this neighborhood, one person died in the 14 months before the invasion. In this same neighborhood, 4 people died in the 18 months after. Therefore, we know the mortality is a little higher in this neighborhood. And we did it 33 times. Unfortunately, when we came to the end, one of the clusters, the city of Fallujah, was just radically different than everywhere else. And everywhere else, the other 32 neighborhoods, violence, which was not a very important cause of death before the invasion, had become the main cause of death. But in Fallujah, essentially, we went to about 30 houses, and there were 52 violent deaths had occurred there. That's, you know, probably 30 times higher, 20 times higher than we saw anywhere else. And now that's not quite true. Maybe 10 times higher than we saw anywhere else. And so Fallujah was so different that we set it aside. So that 100,000 estimate you heard was taking the 32 neighborhoods, excluding Fallujah, because it was so weird and so bad, and saying, if these 32 neighborhoods represent the whole country of Iraq, and we worked very hard to take a sample that did, we believe approximately 100,000 people died. But now we do have that Fallujah information, and we believe it to be true. Just in terms of statistics, we didn't want to put it in and start extrapolating to the whole country. So that's why in our report we said, we think the number's around 100,000 at least, but it could be much higher. And we said it could be much higher because we excluded that Fallujah number. And so that's how we came to our estimate as it appears now in the press.
Professor Roberts, what about the timing of the release of this report and the question about whether this is political?
Yeah, that's really unfortunate. So I tried to do this last April, and if you recall, a couple of people showed up on videos with their heads being cut off, and my colleague out in Baghdad, a fellow named Riyad Lafta, probably the bravest person I've ever met, said, American, you can't come here now. Don't come. And so then we postponed till June. And in June, it was even worse. And then we postponed to July. And then August came around, and starting last week, I have about 6 months' worth of teaching obligations, and so I can't travel. So as we came to the end of August, it was either then or never. And so we did it essentially over a 3-week window in September. We finished the last house on September 20th. I got out of the country about 4 days later. I scrambled and wrote up these results as fast as I could, and they were into The Lancet by the 1st of October. But The Lancet rightly critiqued this quite heavily. They sent it out for multiple critiques from several different reviewers because they didn't want to publish something that was going to be unfair to one side or another, that was going to be bad science. And so it just took this long. I certainly wish that this had come out 2 weeks ago. I wish it had come out 2 weeks ago because then both candidates would be forced to address the issue of casualties in Iraq and would have been forced to pledge their eagerness to protect civilians in the future. So I think the timing is unfortunate. I think the fact that it came out before the election is probably a good thing for the Iraqi people, don't get me wrong. I just wish it had come out a couple weeks earlier so that all the hoopla would be more about the number than about the timing.
And your response to, the report in The Independent, the Pentagon collecting figures on local casualties in Iraq, that the Pentagon is contrary to its public claims, but the results are classified, according to your colleague, one of the authors of this report, Professor Richard Garfield, who is an expert on the effects of conflict on civilians. He lectures at Columbia University here in New York and at London School of Hygiene and Public Health. Saying that since 1991, when Colin Powell was head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the figures have been kept secret. He said, the military is saying we don't believe it, but because we don't collect figures, we can't comment. Mr. Powell decided to keep the figures secret because of the controversy over body counts in Vietnam, but I think democracies need this information. Any more information you have on whether the Pentagon has these figures themselves?
I'm afraid I don't have any information to that effect. I know Richard said that, and I just can't comment. In keeping with Mr. Fisk just said, you know, I went out and I had to sneak into the country because Americans are seen so hostily. So I laid down in the back seat of a car and was smuggled in. And I spent a couple days sort of arranging logistics and getting myself sorted out. And then for 8 days, I went out to the first many clusters and trained our interviewers. And then after that, I hid in a hotel room. Like so many of the reporters out there now, keeping a low profile as a foreigner in Iraq is essential. And so I really can't comment on what the coalition is doing in terms of keeping records or what the Iraqi government is doing in terms of keeping records, except to say that the Ministry of Health themselves admit that their surveillance and monitoring of deaths is extremely incomplete.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. We have been speaking with Les Roberts, who is the co-author of the study on civilian mortality in Iraq since the invasion. He is an epidemiologist at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. The report has appeared in the British medical journal, Lancet.
It's been my pleasure.
It's good to have you with us. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll talk about the NAACP being audited by the IRS after its chair, Julian Bond, criticized Bush administration policies around war, the economy, and education. And we'll also look at what is happening in Florida and around the country. Stay with us.
Peace in our time, peace in our land. Peace is in our hands. Heading to my voting booth. I am the youth. And I care about life. That's why I'm singing. I'm choosing 1 leader to vote for. Wage peace instead of war. My vote makes things right. What you call it, dear? Everybody's moving around. For liberty on Tuesday, we sing the sound. Oh yeah. Head into my voting booth. Oh, yeah. I am the youth. And I care about life. That's why I'm singing. Choosing 1 leader to vote for. Wage peace instead of war. To the bus stop, I found a way to make the war stop.
Oh yeah.
Head into my
ethical culture. The truth, Kalealoha Una Kupuna is in the booth for a trickle down that comes every day where I pick my raindrops. Big beats, big truth, and real justice. Learned a lot from my father and my mother. Big kids in Camelot, Utopia. Hold me and I'm holding you real close. I'm hearing whispers.
We need a peace rhythm. Oh yeah.
Do me right.
Everyone's got love with them.
Oh yeah.
I'll be your voice.
Voting Booth by Kalealoha. That's K-A-L-E-I-A-L-O-H-A. Kalealoha.net. premiered here on Democracy Now. Yes, this is the countdown to the showdown, the battle for New York. Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Three members of Congress are calling on the Internal Revenue Service to drop an investigation into the nonprofit status of the NAACP. The IRS audit comes after its chair, Julian Bond, criticized the Bush administration in a speech at its annual convention in July. At the time, President Bush turned down an invitation to address the NAACP, the country's oldest and largest civil rights organization. In his speech, Chairman Bond criticized Bush's civil rights record, the Iraq War, the high black unemployment rate, and the decline of educational opportunities for African Americans. The letter addressed to the IRS commissioner by three House Democrats, New York Congressmember Charles Rangel, California Congressmember Pete Stark, and Michigan's Congressmember John Conyers. It says, quote, "It's obvious that the timing of this IRS examination is nothing more than an effort to intimidate members of the NAACP. The NAACP's tax-exempt status allows contributors to make tax-deductible contributions but restricts its lobbying efforts. If the IRS investigation determines that the NAACP intervened in a political campaign, the most severe penalty would be loss of its tax-exempt status." The IRS said about 60 charities, churches, and other tax-exempt groups are currently under investigation for possibly breaking federal rules that bar them from participating in political activities. This comes as a new report by OMB Watch, a Washington-based watch group, finds a growing pattern of intimidation and suppression of free speech and advocacy rights of charities and other nonprofits. We're going to address this issue now with the head of the Washington section of the NAACP, and we welcome you to Democracy Now!
It's good to be with you.
It's great to be with you. Can you talk about the attack on the NAACP or the IRS investigation of the NAACP?
No, very good. I think you've laid it out rather well. For our listeners that aren't as aware, 501c3s are not allowed to participate in partisan political activities, but they can participate in political activities and have done it for years and years. You can legally involve yourselves in nonpartisan voter registration, voter education, get out the vote campaigns, as well as voter protection campaigns that the NAACP has been involved in since 1909, the founding of our organization about 95 years ago. We found it rather peculiar, number one, that an investigation would be based on a speech given by the chairman of the National Board of Directors of the NAACP, Julian Bond. And Julian Bond was as critical of Democrats. As a matter of fact, one of the terms he used to describe his concerns over the Democratic Party was them being spineless at a time when the Republican Party was being ruthless about how they were handling things. So he's been very critical of both parties, and all that was done in the context, quite frankly, of a historic analysis of both parties and African-American community involvements with those parties, and those parties' support or lack thereof of the African-American community. So it's peculiar that we received such a letter less than a month prior to an election, when usually that kind of thing doesn't happen. And we talk to people not only on both sides of the aisle, but lawyers that represent organizations in many different political perspectives.
Hillary Shelton with us. How has it affected the NAACP?
Well, I think people that aren't familiar with the organization, and that indeed not only do we not involve ourselves in partisan political activities because of the 501c3 law, we don't involve ourselves in partisan political activities also because the Constitution of the NAACP prohibits it. So as much as we've been trying to make sure people understand that the involvement we've had in political activities is always and will continue to be nonpartisan, we do have people that are not as familiar, and we've actually even gotten a couple inquiries from some of the other nonprofit organizations that we work with, all of which, when understanding what we've been doing and so forth, continue to be very supportive of how we do business.
Hillary Shelton is director of the NAACP Washington Bureau. I'm wondering about the timing of the IRS audit and the role that the NAACP has played, both specifically in Florida NAACP being the organization that brought a lawsuit after the 2000 election over the disenfranchisement of African Americans, and being a part of and a leader of the Election Protection Coalition.
Absolutely. It's had a very chilling effect, as a matter of fact, to our members and coalition partners across the country. Indeed, knowing how safe the NAACP has been in its political activities, for us to be investigated at this point in such a highly contested election makes many others wonder if they can continue to do the kind of political activities they're involved in. And indeed, we are totally committed to our full involvement in the political process to see to it that African Americans and all other Americans are able to cast an unfettered vote, to be left alone and allowed to do what they want to do, to have their voices heard in the ways that we've always worked to make sure their voices could be heard. But it does send a chilling effect for it to happen now. Why would they do an investigation or begin an investigation less than 1 month prior to a presidential election? Normally, these kinds of investigations of your tax status are usually done at the end of your filing period, which would be at the end of the year. So it's amazing to us that this is happening now.
And the reports from South Carolina, Charleston County election officials cautioning South Carolinians Friday to steer clear of a fake letter that threatens the arrest of voters who have outstanding parking tickets or have failed to pay child support.
Absolutely. It's that kind of activity we've been working so hard to bring to the forefront. It has happened in other places across the country, too. They've asked everything from not only outstanding parking tickets and any other citations, but in many cases, flyers went out predominantly in the African-American community saying, when you come to the polls to vote, make sure you bring canceled checks showing you've paid your child custody payments. Make sure that you bring receipts showing that that you've even paid your utility bills, because there will be people at the polling sites to check. And we've had outrageous flyers sent around in some communities saying, don't worry about voting on November 2nd, Tuesday. You can always come back and vote on Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday as well. I mean, those kind of things to disrupt political involvement, to actually suppress the African-American vote, is something that we'll continue to work to prevent.
Finally, I'm looking at a report in Newsday headlined Minorities Voter Rights Raises Concerns. And it's about the civil rights division under Acosta, the civil rights division of the U.S. government. And it says black voters under Acosta, black voters don't even come in second as a priority this year for the civil rights division. He reserves that for overseas voters, according to Department statements in a recent report by the Government Accountability Office.
Well, we have clearly we have clearly pushed Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights to be very actively involved in communities that we suspect are going to be problematic. As you know, with early voting and problems we experienced in the 2000 election, we have a pretty extensive list that we've shared with the Justice Department of areas that we're concerned may very well be a problem as well. We're also concerned that the backlash of sending out prosecutors from the Justice Department to actually observe at polling sites with the sole purpose of bringing criminal cases against individuals and groups is something we're also very fearful of. If indeed police lines are set up in front of polling sites in the African-American community, as we experienced, by the way, in the 2000 election, our armed, uniformed police officers are standing around polling sites, then to many, particularly new African-Americans, those who've come from countries like Haiti and totalitarian governments in Africa that are now U.S. citizens and planning on casting the vote, could also send a very chilling effect and, again, suppress African-American participation.
Hillary Shelton, I want to thank you for being with us, Director of the NAACP, the Washington Bureau. As we turn now to Palm Beach, where Medea Benjamin is standing by, an organizer with the No Stolen Elections campaign. Welcome to Democracy Now.
Hey, Amy. Thanks for having me on.
What's happening in Palm Beach, Florida?
Well, Palm Beach, Florida is the home of the infamous Teresa Lepore and the ballot, the butterfly ballot. She's up to her same tricks this time around, disenfranchising voters. The longest lines in the whole state of Florida for early voting are happening right here, 8 hours and 40 minutes from the yesterday at one of the polling stations, making people who didn't get their absentee ballots stand on those same long lines, even though it was the fault of the county for not sending out the absentee ballots in time. A lot of people will be disenfranchised. And the question is what happens on November 3rd, Amy? And that is a question for the whole United States. If there is a stolen election again, we are trying to organize people around the country, and particularly here in Florida, to say we won't stand by quietly and let it happen again. That's why this No Stolen Election campaign has been put together. And we encourage all your listeners to go onto the website, which is NOV like November, NOV3.us. Take the pledge that you will be out there on the streets with us on November 3rd if need be.
We're also joined by Josh Breitbart, who's working with the Michigan Independent Media Center and is an editor of the Toledo, Ohio-based magazine Clamor, speaking to us from Ann Arbor, Michigan. The Indy Media Network has announced the launch of a new website as part of its special coverage of the 2004 election. Can you talk about the website, Josh?
Yes. Hi, Amy.
Hi, it's good to have you with us.
It's the USIMC. It's a site to collect all information from the over 50 independent media centers around the country. And it's particularly useful now because we don't know where news is going to break around the country on November 2nd and on November 3rd. And we're here, we're throughout the country, and this new website, indymedia.us, is there to gather the information from wherever it may come.
There's also something interesting going on, a kind of continuation of what we saw outside the Republican National Convention, the whole text mob approach. Can you explain it and explain what you're doing right now?
Yeah, well, we learned lessons from February 15th, 2003, with the international war protests, where there were reports from all over the world being gathered together in this network forum. And at the RNC, we learned how to take breaking news calls and send out alerts through text messaging. But we've greatly expanded that capability. Instead of just sort of using these local loops where people can email back and text message back and forth, people are using these tools to notify tens of thousands of people where their polling places are tomorrow morning. We can also use them to send out alerts to, you know, whether they're relevant to Ohio or relevant to the whole country. And you can sign up for the Michigan IMC alerts at michiganimc.org.
And say how people can sign up to get these alerts one more time.
You go to michiganimc.org, and again, if you just go to indymedia.us, and all the information will be linked from there, and hopefully on the Democracy Now! Site as well.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Josh Breitbart, for joining us, working with the Michigan Independent Media Center and on the launch of indymedia.us. Emadia Benjamin, organizer with the No Stolen Elections campaign, speaking to us from Palm Beach, Florida. And that does it for our coverage. Democracy Now! Will be doing on the morning after a two-hour special on Wednesday morning, as we will broadcast either the outcome of the elections or where we stand at that point. DemocracyNow.org, you can get latest information. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdel-Kaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill. Ryan Abernathy is our engineer. And on Wednesday, Democracy Now! Will head out to Stony Brook University, State University of New York, Stony Brook, 4 o'clock, the Wang Center Auditorium, for an address as we continue the Exception to the Rulers tour, honoring media that is the exception to the rulers. And on Thursday, we'll be in Stanford at 7:30 at night for a panel looking at the elections. DemocracyNow.org is our website. You can sign up there for our daily digest email list at www.democracynow.org. Look forward to your comments. You can tell us what's happening in your state, and we'll read some of those comments tomorrow at mail@democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.